Okay, so good morning, Person Ishimori. Thank you very much for joining me. As we
Good
were
morning.
just discussing, the goal of this series of interviews is to go through the history of the ideas and the context around the replica symmetry breaking and spinning glasses more as and their applications, which we roughly bound in time from 1975 to 1995. Though we will deviate from this because of these because of the natural aspects of these questions. But before we dive into the heart of this topic, I'd like to ask you a few questions on your own background. So first, can you tell us a few things about your youth and how you became interested in science in the first place?
Well, in my younger days at high school and before, I was very much interested in mathematics rather than physics or chemistry, science. I was very fascinated by computations, calculations, and honestly, I was not very much interested in physics itself. But after entering university and learning what real mathematics was, well, my interest deviated from mathematics with rigorous logic toward physics, theoretical physics, with lots of computations. That's how my interest started in physics.
And so, why did you attend the University of Tokyo in physics? Was there, I mean, what drew you to Tokyo?
Well, I was raised in a remote area of Japan, in the island of Shikoku, the western part, and it didn't have honestly very active universities in the field of science and technology. So I looked for a place to learn more vigorously about science and mathematics, and which naturally drew me to Tokyo.
And then what led you to pursue graduate studies in statistical mechanics with Professor Suzuki based on coming from that background?
Well, I took courses of physics, and Professor Suzuki, Master Suzuki, taught the course of statistical physics. He taught very enthusiastically. We learned that he was very much fascinated and loved statistical physics, and that attitude attracted me to the field rather than the subject itself. I was interested in very much broad spectrum of physics, including particle physics and nuclear physics, but Professor Suzuki's attitude was the main motivation that I entered the field.
So can you describe a bit the University of Tokyo at that time? Because Professor Suzuki himself was part of the Kubo group, I think.
Yes.
So
Professor Kubo led a very large group. He was very famous, and he attracted a lot of students. He and Professor Suzuki and Professor Wada, three professors, formed a group of statistics from physics, and almost 20 or 30 students belonged to that group. It was a very big group, and the group was very active. Students were discussing with each other very frequently. We had lunch, we had dinner, we had sports events, and so I enjoyed those days very much.
once you joined Professor Suzuki's research group, how did you first become aware of spinning glasses? Or did you know about them beforehand, or?
Well, I don't think I knew I had known the subject of spin glasses before I joined the group. But after joining the group, I soon realized that everyone was interested in spin glasses because the topic was very actively studied and very fashionable at that time, as probably everybody in this field knows today. So naturally, I became aware, I became acquainted with that topic of spin glasses.
Do you know where Professor Suzuki's own interest in the topic come from?
Well, he was generally interested in phase transitions and critical phenomena. And he had been working on that topic for many years. And Professor Suzuki, I don't know how he became acquainted with the spinglass theory itself, but he was studying the spinglass theory at the time using a random type mean field analysis. So I learned from him the topic, and I studied very many papers on that field, on that problem.
I see. So for your thesis, where did the idea of using gauge transformations to solve spin glass models originate?
Well, it's a bit long story, but I was generally fascinated by the duality transformation of the Kramers-Warian type, and that was a very clever trick to predict the exact value of the critical point of non-random systems in two dimensions. It was a very simple theory, but it has a very powerful aspect to predict the exact value of the transient point of the Ising model, which was later confirmed by Larsson-Sagra's well-known exact solution. So I learned it, and I was very fascinated by that topic, and I tried to generalize it to random systems, which was not done, which had not been done, I thought. And I first applied it to random ferromagnetic systems. The sign of the interaction was ferromagnetic, but the amplitude was random. That topic was also pursued at that time. I tried to apply the method of duality transformation to that random ferromagnetic systems, and I achieved something using the replica trick, indeed. But the replica trick didn't work very well for that system. Not exactly, I mean. It worked to some extent, but it didn't yield the exact solution. I thought it was the exact solution, but it was pointed out by someone later that it was not exact, but approximately good. So I proceeded to apply the method to the spin glass case with both signs of interactions, plus and minus, the so-called Edwards-Anderson model in two dimensions. But there was a difficulty in analyzing that model by duality because with a negative sign, antiferromagnetic interactions in the original model, some of it negative signs appears in the spin glass system naturally. And with negative sign, the dual variable, dual coupling becomes imaginary. So it was not very physically meaningful. But I managed to transform that imaginary value of the coupling constant to a real value, real positive ferromagnetic coupling by using auxiliary value, which corresponds to the correlation function of non-random ferromagnetic system. So it was non-trivial step. That procedure had been known for years in retrospect, but I didn't know it. So I developed that idea. So in short, I transformed the partition function of a spin glass system to the correlation function of a non-random ferromagnetic system in two dimensions by the duality transformation. And in that process, I found that a class of spin glass systems with some properties correspond to the same correlation function in the pure system. So I analyzed the properties of this class of random spin systems, and I recognized that those spin glass systems share the same distribution of frustration. So I then came up with the idea to connect those random spin glass systems with the same distribution of frustration, which turned out to be the gauge transformation. This way, I found the gauge transformation to connect various distribution of randomness with the same distribution of frustration. So the concept of gauge transformation, I didn't know the word, but I came up with the idea naturally. And after that, I recognized that the same idea had been reached by a group of very famous particle physicists, Fradkin, Huberman, Schenker. And I was very disappointed, of course, as a student. I can't compete with those very famous professors, but I soon recognized by reading their paper in Physical Review B, it was Physical Review B, that they formulated gauge transformation, but they didn't derive any exact solutions. So I went beyond their results by deriving the exact solution for the spin glass system. So I could publish the paper, I could write a paper.
So how was that paper received when it came out?
Well, when I first presented my result at the JPS meeting, I announced the result, and immediately after my talk, the chairman stood up and said that your result contradicts all the known results. He meant that the fact that the internal energy that I derived didn't have any singularity at all. It was very simple hyperbolic tangent of the inverse temperature. So it's something that even a high school student knows, no singularity at all. But the condition that I derived that exact result involved a point of phase transition. So across a phase transition, I showed that the internal energy had no singularity at all, which was very curious. So he pointed it out. It was natural for him to point it out that way. But it was the exact result. I declared I could say nothing more. So it was not accepted. And I also wrote a paper, manuscript of that result, and submitted it to a journal published somewhere in the United Kingdom. And the referee responded that, saying that I clearly remember what the referee said. The statement was that the model is artificial and the result is thin to warrant publication. Just a single line. a piece of paper of this size, 1 centimeter and 10 centimeters, it was enclosed in an envelope. I was shocked. But, well, in retrospect, my paper was not very well written. So I revised the manuscript over and over again several times, and finally I could convince the referee that the paper was worth publication. So I was very discouraged by those first responses, but Professor Suzuki encouraged me, saying that exact results will stand the test of time. So I was very much relieved by his remark.
Mm-hmm. So those first few papers on spin glasses do not actually make any reference to replica symmetry breaking. So were you aware of these ideas at the time when you published your works?
Yes. I read the papers by Edwards and Anderson, Sherrington, Kirkpatrick.
And Parisi as well, or...?
No, I don't think so. So I read those papers by Sherrington, Kirkpatrick, and Edwards Anderson, but I didn't follow the development of replica symmetry breaking in late 70s because I was more interested in gauge transformation rather than replica symmetry or replica symmetry breaking.
So when did the awareness of ideas of replica symmetry breaking make it to Professor Suzuki's group and for you and your colleagues in Tokyo?
I myself vaguely knew the idea of replica symmetry breaking, the fact that the idea were developing among Europeans mainly. And Professor Suzuki one time attended a conference in Europe. I don't know where it was, but he returned home and said to us that Giorgio Parisi proposed a very complicated mathematical way to avoid the problem of negative entropy in the ground state for the Sherrington-Kirkpatrick model. we were very impressed. But he also added that the trick, his method was too mathematical and artificial. So he didn't believe it, he said, I thought. So I therefore forgot about it later, afterwards.
Were you at all? I mean, so Professor Suzuki had contacts in Europe, but were you in touch with European scientists at the time in France, Italy, in the
No,
UK?
no, no. I was a student, and it was very difficult for Japanese to visit foreign countries at that time because of the geographic isolation, and the airfare was very expensive. And but some of them visited Japan for conferences. And I should have met some of them, but I don't remember who they were.
So after your thesis, you went to the United States for postdocs, first with Griffiths and then with so how did this idea come about? What were you hoping to gain or to work on during your postdoc?
Well, Professor Bob Griffiths from Carnegie Mellon University was very famous for his work on mathematical physics, of course, and I knew several of his work. And he sent a call of postdoctoral position to many people in the world, including Professor Suzuki, by postal mail, of course. And he posted, Professor Suzuki posted that call on the little board of a group, and I came across it. And one time, one day, one evening, I went home on the subway, and I met Professor Suzuki on that train, and I talked about it, and Professor Suzuki very strongly suggested me to apply for it, and apply for it, and I did, and Professor Bob Griffiths accepted. This way, I went to the United States, and it was. But the contract was just for a year because Professor Griffiths planned to leave for Paris for sabbatical after 1 year. So I started applying for the next position soon after arriving at Pittsburgh. And Professor Michael Stephen, Rutgers University, accepted my application.
So with in that second postdoc, you worked with Professor Stephen on a POTS glass model. What interested you in this particular model?
Well, Professor Michael Stephen was an expert of the POTS model. He wrote several papers on the POTS model, but without randomness. So he was interested in the spin glass analysis using gauge transformation through my talk at Rutgers statistical mechanics meeting organized by Joe Lewis there at math department. And so he accepted my application. He soon proposed me to work on the POTS model with randomness. So we started working on it.
So what you, I mean, you one of the findings of that model is that there's a first order transition for certain values of Q. Was that, I mean, that turned out later on to be quite important. What were you making of that finding at the time? Was this surprising or was this interesting or?
Well, I knew that the non-random POTS model with long-range mean field type interactions went under first order transition for large Q, for the large number of components. And we generalized it to the random case. But I was not very much surprised because we knew that POTS model without randomness went under first order transition. So it was natural generalization, I thought. And what we did was not very much complicated using the replica method in the way that Sherrington Kirkpatrick did. And we generalized it to the POTS case, and we used just a random type argument to judge the nature of the transition as the first order. So it was very natural. I should say I was not very much surprised. It was natural, I thought.
So was it, I mean, was Professor Stephen also familiar with the replica trick, or was this your contribution there as well.
He should have known generally, but I don't think he had any explicit experience of using the replica method to analyze random systems. But he was apparently interested in that trick after listening to my talk at the Rutgers meeting.
So after that 1 year at Rutgers, I think you went back to Japan to take up a faculty position, and then you worked with a student, Yoshihiro Taguchi, and Takehiro Ogushi, I think, who was his supervisor on quantum spin glasses. What were your what where did this idea of you introducing quantum effects and spin glasses come from, and how did this collaboration also come about?
I didn't work on quantum spin systems. I hadn't worked on quantum spin systems very much until I returned to Tokyo after my postdoc days in the United States. But Professor Oguchi had been working on many topics of statistical mechanics of spin systems, including quantum spin systems such as Heisenberg model and the XY model. And Professor Oguchi had a very large group, and he very frequently invited nearby faculty members and students for lunch. And I joined those occasions, and we had a chat, many chats over lunch, and which included quantum spin systems. So he was working on the properties of the ground state of frustrated non-random frustrated quantum systems, such as the antiferromagnetic Heisenberg model on the triangular lattice, which was a very fashionable topic at that time, around the middle of 1980s. And he was working on it by various methods, including numerical diagonalization of large matrices representing those quantum spin systems. So I learned that topic that way and by conversation over lunch. And Professor Oguchi suggested me to work on it as well if I was interested in numerical computations, but I didn't have experience in diagonalization, numerical diagonalization of quantum spin systems. But Professor Oguchi was a very big name at that time in Japan and the community of statistical physics. So I said vaguely yes. So I started working on it, but soon I became very fascinated by that method because computers work as programmed. And I just write the program and the computer spits out the answer correctly, unlike analytical calculations, which made a lot of errors when I worked on it. So, of course, there were bugs in the computer programs, but they were simple to fix. So, I was soon fascinated by that method, and I wrote very many versions of the program, and I soon became very fascinated, familiar with that method. And at one time, I made a world record of numerical diagonalization of quantum spin systems, which was with 27 spins. It was a world record at the time in the late 1988, in the late 98, 1980s. Professor Oguchi was very impressed by the result and encouraged me to go further. And that attitude was very relatively rare as an old established figure in Japan at the time. In retrospect, he was very fair. And Yoshihiro Taguchi, as a student, joined the project, and we very energetically studied a number of ground state problems of quantum spin systems numerically and analytically. And we naturally extended that method to the random spin systems. with quantumness, because computer programs didn't care if the interactions were random or not.
So you afterwards, well, not long after that, actually, you worked on the perceptron and the Hopfield model and neural networks more generally. How did you get interested in this class of problems?
Well, that topic of neural networks, in particular the Hopfield model, was very popular at that time, around 1990s, mainly because of the famous paper by John Hopfield proposing the model under his name recently. And also the topic became very active by the famous papers by three Israeli scientists, Daniel Amit, Hanok Gutfreund, and Chaim Samplinski. Those papers represented direct applications of the Spengler theory, the neural network model, the Hopfield model. So it was they were very beautiful papers, although it involved a lot of complicated computations using the replica method and its symmetry breaking. And frankly, I didn't very much care about the physics of the neural network problem, but I was very strongly attracted by the technical aspects of those developments, including replica symmetry and replica symmetry breaking. And so I became aware of that topic this way.
So you became aware of it mostly through reading papers, or were you traveling
yes.
to Israel or traveling to Europe where these communities were established?
No. As I said, it was very difficult for young researchers to go abroad from Japan to the
So
United
even
States.
even as a faculty, that remained a challenge.
Yes. I didn't have a lot of funding at that time.
So what was your impression of the community then from such a distance?
Well, as I said, I didn't have direct communications with that community of neural networks or error correcting codes or string classes in general. But I respected those physicists working on those topics of neural network theory because, or error correcting codes, because they found very interesting problems outside of physics, but yet solved by physics-based physics-based approaches.
Yeah, so in a couple of years later, you tried in yet another direction, as you were mentioning, in error correcting codes. How did you get interested in that problem in turn and its connection to spin glasses? Was it also through the literature or?
Yes, through our literature. In fact, Professor Paul Ryan from Germany sent me a preprint. He knew my work on spin glass theory, and by postal mail, of course, at the time. And his manuscript, which was later published in Physical Review Letters, in that paper, he showed numerically, by numerical methods, that the coding of an error correcting code comes optimal in some sense at the finite temperature that corresponds to the so-called Nishimori line in the phase diagram of the Spengler theory. So I didn't have any knowledge about error correcting codes at that time, but I was fascinated. I was attracted by his statements. So I started to learn that topic very vigorously and understood what it meant and started to work on it to prove that his numerical result was indeed correct, and I could prove it analytically. So during that process, I learned that Nicolas Soulas from Paris opened that field for physicists by his famous paper appeared in Nature. But I just worried why it was published in Nature, that mathematical topic.
So you later collaborated with a researcher in Hong Kong, right, Michael Wong, on the statistical mechanics of both error correcting codes and image restoration. What, I mean, was there a natural sequence of papers from your original work to that one, or is it fairly discontinuous, or how did this come about altogether?
I didn't know the topic of image restoration from the perspective of statistical mechanics. Michael Wong, I met him several times at conferences and we knew each other, and he invited me to apply for visitor's position at his university, Hong Kong University of Science and Technology, and applied, and I was accepted and stayed there for several months. And he taught me the topic of image restoration and was proposed to work on it by using a mean field type theory corresponding to the spinglass physics. So we started working on it this way.
So, how were you involved? I mean, so these topics are typically more sort of information theory topics that appear in, say, computer science or engineering, electrical engineering departments. Was there anyone in these communities with whom you could be in touch in Japan or around, or was this purely a physics treatment in your experience?
The latter, the physics experience, and Paul Luyan and Michael Wong taught me those topics through their papers and through direct communications with, in the case of Michael Wong. So I didn't know what was the perception of those developments from the perspective electrical engineering community. I was just involved in the physics community coming.
Okay, so you never went to engineering meetings to present this work, or no? Okay.
Not at all. Just at previous meeting and papers.
So shortly after that, you start to work on quantum annealing, which I guess drew you away from these topics, error correcting codes and the like. Was there any connection between this new direction and the work you had done on spin glasses and complex systems before then?
Yes, in some sense. I started to work on the quantum version of the Hopf field model neural networks with a postdoc, Yoshihiro Nonomura, in the middle 1990s. And the Hopf field model was solved exactly by Amit Gundfroy Samplinsky about 10 years ago. And I came up with the idea to introduce quantum effects in the top in the Hopf field model in the form of transverse field, the X component of the Pauli matrix. And I worked on it very vigorously, and we came up with the result that surprised us, in the sense that the quantum effects in the form of the transverse field had almost the same role. It played almost the same role as the temperature thermal classical thermal effects does in the case of the classical Hopf-Hill model. So this way I started to work on quantum problems very vigorously.
So the work that had been done in the early 80s on classical annealing in complex systems, was that a parallel or a source of inspiration to that quantum annealing?
Yes. We, of course, everyone was had known work of Scott Kirkpatrick and others on simulated annealing. And I, of course, knew that work. And I, as I said, I found that quantum effects in the Hopf field model played a same role, almost the same role as the classical thermal effects does in the classical model. So I combined those two ideas to try to find the ground state of the classical spin glass using quantum effects instead of classical thermal effects, which naturally led to the idea of quantum annealing.
I see. And a few years later, you started using quantum annealing to study quantum spin glass models. What was the motivation for studying this class of model and in this way?
Well, in our first paper on quantum annealing in 1998 with Tadashi Kadowaki, we studied spin glass problem cell because I had been studying the spin glass problem for long times, and I of course knew that the identification of the ground state properties was a very difficult but important problem. And quantum annealing was designed to find the ground state of the Ising model with general interactions, including the random case. So it was very natural for me to apply the idea of quantum annealing to the spin glass systems. And we found very surprisingly at that time that quantum effects was better to find the ground state than classical thermal effects. Better in the sense that the probability of finding the ground state was much higher quantum case than the classical case. We didn't know why, but the numerical results showed that. So this way I entered the field.
Okay, I see. So, sort of in parallel, in over the last 20 years, there was a revival of interest in at what you call the so-called Nishimori line and its importance in mathematical physics circles. Have you paid attention to the use of mathematical physics to study spinning glasses? Up until that point.
Not so much. I knew that my results were used under some context in mathematical physics, information related problems, but I didn't follow those papers very seriously, partly because I was working on quantum annealing very vigorously. I didn't have any capacity to work on the spin glass theory or its applications. Partly because I didn't think I had any idea to work on it beyond my old method in my thesis.
So, how did your collaboration with Pierluigi Contucci and your student Satoshi Morita then arise and
Well, Pierluigi Contucci was very interested in my method to derive the exact solution for the spin glass problem, and he contacted me by email already at the time, and he visited me, and he naturally proposed the idea to use our method to various problems that I didn't know.
So after that collaboration, you again, well, I mean, you didn't pursue much in the mathematical physics of spinning glasses, but did you keep abreast of what happened in the years since?
Well, frankly, not so much again. I paid attention from time to time, but I didn't work very vigorously unless I was invited to do so, like Pierluigi did.
So one of the collaborators you worked on for many years is David Sherrington, from the mid 90s up until for a decade or more after that. How did you get to know David and to go spend a sabbatical at Oxford in 1994?
Of course, he was very famous, and we met at a few conferences. He visited Japan once or twice, and we met, and probably I met him at some conference in Europe or in Europe, probably. I don't remember. I'm sorry where it was, but he was very friendly, as all know, and He was very, of course, active, and I was very attracted by his character. And I was looking for somewhere to spend sabbatical, so I applied. I asked him to accept me, and he did.
And but you kept working for many more years after that sabbatical.
Yes.
Where were the ideas for problems coming from?
Well, mainly from communications with David Sherrington. I think I don't remember very clearly, but well, David Sherrington proposed the idea of some problem, and we started to talk about it to each other. And, I'm sorry, I don't remember very clearly, but probably it was David Sherrington who proposed the idea.
But did you keep visiting Oxford regularly, or just was largely through email, or?
Largely through email. Yes. I think I visited from once or twice, or more than once, more than twice, but very frequently.
But you did organize his co-organize at least his 65th birthday party. How did that and the conference associated with it? How did that come about?
Well, it was a very impressive meeting, and Tom Cullen, who was probably postdoc and David Sherrington, when I spent a sabbatical there, and we made a friend, and we communicated from time to time. And Tom Cullen invited me to join the organization of birthday conference. It was a very impressive conference, yes.
It looked like, yeah, it was a pretty big event, I think.
Yes. Many famous people gathered and talked about very recent, active, interesting topics. Yes.
During your time at the Tokyo Institute of Technology or elsewhere, did you ever teach about spinning glasses and or replica symmetry breaking? And if yes, can you detail what those classes might have been and to whom?
Yes, I taught a graduate course of statistical physics at Tokyo Institute of Technology many times for over 2 decades or more. And I taught about very many topics, including spin glasses and replica symmetric solution. But I didn't give details of the replica symmetry breaking because it was too advanced for general physics students. And I taught the same topics at several other universities in Japan as guest lecturer, but that's all. I should say I didn't teach the replica symmetry breaking to students, but replica symmetric solution.
I see. So when would this have started the first time, approximately?
Probably around 1990.
Okay. So you eventually wrote a book in Japanese called The Statistical Physics of Spin Glasses and Information Processing. Was this at all related to the class you were teaching?
Yes. The book was a collection of my lecture notes on the subject at Tokyo Tech and other universities, and but the contents were greatly expanded by including many advanced topics such as the replica symmetry breakings and neural networks. And I thought the topic was too advanced for the reader of books in Japan, but the editor of the book from Iwanami Publisher, Mr. Yoshida, encouraged me, and he said, "Write everything you want to write. We don't care if the book doesn't sell." It was a very fair attitude, but it sold a lot.
So you never taught using that book as a textbook, or?
I did. I used that book in my course. I used part of the book in the course, of
But
course.
never the replica symmetry breaking part.
Never, never, never.
Okay.
Yeah, there is a concept of reflectometry breaking, which was very useful and very beautiful. But I said, but if you are interested, you can read the book.
So this book got quickly translated to English at Oxford University Press. How did that happen?
Well, Professor David Charrington was on the governing board of the Oxford University Press. So he was looking for someone to write a book for the Oxford University Press, and he asked me to do so. So I followed his suggestion.
So I think, so as you said, the Japanese book was very well received. It sold well. And how was the Oxford book received? Did it also have a good reception?
Yes, generally, I think so. But I vaguely remember that book review appeared in some journal about my book on the Spinger theory. And I don't remember the statement very clearly, but the review was not very friendly. It was too mathematical, too complicated for the audience. It vaguely said that way, I remember.
I see.
But it's widely read recently, partly because of the developments that you mentioned related to information theory related developments recently. So since the book had been on the market for more than 20 years, I decided to make it open access so that students can read it more easily. And I already made an arrangement with Oxford University Press, and the open access version will appear in several months.
Oh, thank you. So we went broadly over this period. Is there anything else that we may have about this era that we may have missed or skipped over inadvertently that you think would be germane to this?
Well, no, I don't think so at this point.
And in closing, do you still have notes or papers or correspondence that concerns this topic? And if yes, do you intend to deposit them in an academic archive at some point?
Unfortunately, no. I retired officially as a professor about 3 years ago. And at that time, I discarded almost all those materials because I don't need it. I thought I wouldn't need them. The only one that I still keep is the computation notes about the quantum Hopf field model, which involved a lot of computations, more than 100 pages, and I couldn't discard those notes because I thought I may have to follow them once again to do something beyond. So if you are interested, I can show them to you, but that's the only one. And other one that I remember, but I don't have the copy itself, is the statement by the referee to my first paper on the exact solution, which said, this is the correct statement. This is the statement that I correctly remember because it was very impressive. The model is artificial and the result is thin to warrant publication.
Professor Nishimori, thank you very much for this discussion.
You're welcome.